You're listening to The
Bike Show on Resonance
104.4
FM.
Welcome to The Bike Show with me, Jack Thurston. On The Bike Show today, we're going to be looking in some detail at an issue that affects the life of every cyclist, but that is rarely studied and little understood. Road safety statistics will tell us that for the same distance travelled, we're more likely as cyclists to come to physical harm than we would be if we were taking another mode of transport, like driving or public transport. But even so, crashes on a bike are quite rare. Much more common, yet much less studied and understood, are the almost crashes, the near misses, that are so much a part of the experience of cycling in Britain that we consider them unremarkable. It's just something that is part of cycling. Here with me to talk about near misses are two members of the Near Miss Project, a new academic study that's attempting to find out more about near misses. They are Dr. Rachel Aldred, Senior Lecturer in Transport at the University of Westminster, and Dr. Kat Jungnickel, Lecturer in Sociology at Goldsmiths, University of London. And we're joined by John Dales, a traffic engineer and transport planner who is currently Director of Urban Movement, a transport and urban design consultancy. Welcome all. We've got a real brains trust here to talk about near misses. So what is a near miss, Rachel, and why do they matter?
In the Near Miss Project, we're allowing cyclists themselves to define what they see as a near miss or similar incident. So basically, we're gathering a lot of data where people say this is a problem incident, this is a near miss, and so on. They're incidents that don't involve injury, but that nevertheless may be very problematic for people cycling.
I mean, I get a sense of it that it's one of those things where your heart leaps. You feel like, oh my gosh, I was almost run down there. You kind of get angry. You maybe get drawn into an altercation. You know, we all know what they're like. You're relying on cyclists themselves to decide what they think is a near miss.
Yeah, very much so. That's the way the project is going, because we think it's important to find out how these incidents make people feel and what people see as, for example, the most scary incidents, because some incidents potentially are more comic than scary. But as you said, you know, there are a lot of incidents that do have that heart racing, that terror potentially. So we're trying to find out about the different kinds of incident and the effect they have on people.
But nobody gets hurt in a near miss by definition. So why do they matter?
I think there's two reasons, really. So the first reason is that potentially, thankfully, deaths on the roads are relatively rare. But if you study the situations where things nearly happen, potentially that can be an early warning. It's used in that way in the air industry, for example. So it can be a warning of where things might happen that are more serious. But secondly, that people feel safe while cycling is really important, actually, and people are put off cycling because of the fear of being injured. So if we can look at the situations that make people frightened and try and reduce those, that can also be important for cycling uptake and cycling experience.
Okay, so what did the near miss study set out to discover?
Well, a central part of the study, the main bit of academic research that we did, involved an online diary study. So we recruited cyclists, nearly 1,700 in the end, who were asked to record over one specific day, which was chosen in advance over a two-week period, any incidents that were near misses or that they found scary and or annoying that happened to them on that day while they were cycling. So we got a record of everything that people considered a near miss or a problem incident. And we ended up with a data set involving nearly 5,000 reported incidents from nearly 1,700 daily diaries.
Do you, Kat and John, do you think that there's something that's worth studying? I mean, Kat, you're obviously on the project. You're a sociologist, not a transport planner. Where does your interest in the subject come from?
Well, I think, as Rachel was saying, the concept of the near miss is kind of well known by cyclists on a kind of colloquial level. Like, everyone kind of has a near miss story and they emerge quite quickly and easily, but it's not that well known outside. And nor have these kind of experiences really been kind of recognised or kind of explored as being kind of critical to the cycling experience.
John, you look at all different modes of transport, how people get around. Are near misses, do you think, particular to cycling?
No, they can be anything. I mean, anybody is likely to, you know, as a driver, you can screech on the anchors and say, you know, a few choice words about what that person should have done that put you in danger as a pedestrian. Anybody could do that, more or less. And I think that the key thing from our perspective is interesting what Rachel was saying, just about, in your question, well, why? You know, if nobody gets hurt, what's the problem? Well, I think the point is well made about it possibly being an early indicator. So for me, it's all about how might this information help me design a street that's better, safer. one of the real problems about designing streets is you're dealing with people, which is brilliant and wonderful, but fantastically complex. And we do need to take into account how people will react to what they perceive. And we often say that perceptions are real. And one of the problems we have in this particular area is you might have a street, for example, where the road safety record or the collision record shows nobody got hit by anything ever. And you think, well, it's wonderfully safe. But then you look and you think, well, what's not happening in the street, perhaps, because there's no pedestrians there. There are no people cycling because they perceive it to be very dangerous. So if we want more people walking or more people cycling, we need to design with that in mind. And it's very difficult to do so, because we're not so sure about subjective stuff. So anything that can help us get a handle on how people or why people will do something or won't do something is going to be very helpful in terms of how we design our streets.
Let's get to the results. Rachel, you've been number crunching with this large data set of survey responses, and it was quite a detailed survey. What have you found so far?
We asked people to complete a day diary between the 20th of October and the 2nd of November. So there was this 2-week period, and around 90% of trips took place during the week. And there were some quite substantial differences between the types of trips. So the weekend, people were more likely to be making longer leisure trips. I think the longest trip that somebody made took 14 hours. So I looked at that data, and yes, they did actually make a 14-hour trip. It was a long ride. The shortest trip was 10 minutes. The average distance reported was 15 miles or so. But this did, as I say, vary dramatically.
That seems like a huge distance. 15, as an average.
15 miles as an average. It was slightly less than that during the week. I think what we're getting is a lot of commute trips, sort of round commute trips, perhaps with other things added in. So people travelling, maybe sort of 6 or 7 miles one way, 6 or 7 miles the other way. There's an average of just over 3 incidents reported during a cycling day. So about nearly 3 incidents per hour, or 1 incident every 3 miles. So that's the kind of levels we're seeing. Where there was a really standout difference was when you looked at the week versus the weekend. And the weekend riders seemed to do much better. So they had about half the rate of incidents of the weekday riders. And that is potentially, when we looked at it, then you could see that the weekend riders were potentially doing these longer leisure trips, which seemed to have a lower risk of incidents. There was also a difference by time of day. So the morning peak really stood out as being a time when more incidents took place per hour cycled.
And so what kind of incidents were being described by people who were reporting their near misses? What kind of manoeuvres, what kind of environments were these near misses happening in?
The most commonly reported incidents are blocking, which might involve something in the way as a cyclist, or it might involve a pedestrian stepping out. It might involve a vehicle, perhaps a parked vehicle, where the cyclist is attempting to ride. A couple of other very commonly reported incidents are passing, specifically close passing, where a driver overtakes and the cyclist feels it's too close, and also pulling in or pulling out. So I guess a classic example, a driver is pulling out of a side road, maybe doesn't notice the cyclist has to screech to a halt. So those are three very commonly reported incidents. And of those involving motor vehicles, because not all the incidents do involve a motor vehicle, the most commonly reported is a passing incident. So maybe around 1 in 3 of these incidents are close passes. So that looms quite large, I think.
People have talked about small animals running across the path of cyclists and pedestrians unexpectedly stepping out onto the road or weaving between idling traffic. Passengers exiting cars was also a source of near misses for some cyclists. Many mentioned infrastructural issues such as pinch points and prematurely ended cycle paths, which place the cyclist in precarious positions. Poor road surfaces were mentioned a lot. Especially in winter, there were reports of rotting leaves that created slippery surfaces, also broken glass and puddles and gravel. Disfigured road surfaces caused by heavy vehicles kind of created lumpy bits of road. And, of course, potholes. Potholes emerged quite a lot. And all of these, of course, require a cyclist to ride offensively and kind of swerve out of the way. And many also, as Rachel said, talked about close passes. You know, cars passing too close or cutting them off at intersections, or a few cases of overtaking and then braking too quickly, or even reversing with little notice back onto a cyclist. I found quite interesting, you know, references to kind of high beam lights, particularly out in kind of more rural areas. You know, cyclists talked about being dazzled and temporarily blinded by cars that drivers that didn't dim their lights for cyclists, as they would do to car drivers. And part of that annoyance of this experience is not just the danger of not being able to see, but also kind of not being recognised as kind of a legitimate road user. Kind of an everyday level of discourtesy kind of emerges in some of the reports. And also occasions of bullying were noted, you know, in the form of driving too close or of revving engines or punishment passes were talked about, or abuse being shouted out at cyclists. So analysis is still in its early stages, but what's fascinating is how many of these instances emerge in kind of combinations or assemblies of things. So that otherwise would possibly just be annoyances, but when they're kind of combined, they create these conditions of near misses. So cyclists, you know, talk about, you know, there was a large rut in the road surface that means I have to cycle out into the road to avoid it. So these combinations of things become quite interesting, and we're going to be analysing more of those in the future.
So I think in about 15 minutes we've managed to present probably the most unappealing, unattractive vision of cycling in the entire decade-long history of the bike show. So congratulations on that. But I mean, is this a great project of doom-mongering, and should we, you know, is this putting people off cycling, this the kind of looking at this in detail and saying, hey, look, there's all these near misses all the time, dangerising cycling? Is that something that we should be worried about?
Very much we're looking for solutions, we're looking to improve things. We're aware that, you know, many people do carry on cycling despite these experiences because of the benefits of cycling, because it's such a great thing to do. And cycling would be something for many more people if we could reduce these kinds of incidents. You know, we're going to be making recommendations around infrastructure, we're going to be making recommendations around enforcement, around training, and so on. So we hope that this can contribute to making cycling the great experience it really should be.
And also just bringing it to light, the things that we kind of enfold into the ordinariness of every day. You know, you don't even really think about these things until someone really draws your attention to it, because you've just said, well, that's just how it is. Well, perhaps it doesn't have to be like that. Perhaps there are ways in which it could be different or could be better, it could be more kind of inclusive of a whole different range of people. And I was just thinking of some of the things that people have been saying. You know, someone said, I face this every day of my commute for several years, so now I'm used to these problems. But this survey has reminded me of how I take poor infrastructure for granted.
I mean, I think the whole purpose of it is to make sure that actually people have fewer of these incidents. But it's not just that the existing cyclists have fewer of these incidents, that there are less of them, so that people who aren't cycling at the moment because they think they might have them will cycle because they won't have them. I'd hate, and I don't suppose it will work this way, that this research becomes a headline, which is thousands of cyclists terrified every day, you know, which has been a driver for a lot of cycle training in the past, which is you better have training because otherwise, because it's terrifyingly dangerous out there. But rather, it will influence design so that these things will be less frequent, so that, again, coming back to why do we care about this at all? I mean, cycling, people not. Why are we remotely interested in that? It's because it's a really good thing for cities to have, is more cycling. That's a policy priority we've got. If we really want it to play out, we are going to have to design and do other things that that basically respond to how people, real people, really are. And I suppose the key thing as a designer that this speaks to me in terms of the failures that my profession has had, and I'll be quite frank, there are many, when it comes to that, and it comes back possibly in relation to that point about the dazzling lights, which is, for the most part, British traffic engineers have never really been asked to design for cycles as traffic. That ordinary everyday respect that Kat just spoke of hasn't really been part of us. Bit of a minority thing. We'll do something if we can. And if there's not a particular problem, it's already been mentioned that the actual collision stats aren't that bad relative to others. Yes, they're a little bit worse, but actually it's a very small user group. And all the other things that are on our plate, we tend not to have focused on it. The moment we do focus on it, however, we can see whether it's at the ordinary everyday level of a pothole, or of a cycle lane suddenly ending, or of us not making sure or trying to enforce against cars or others abusing cycle facilities because they're frankly able to abuse them because they're only advisory rather than mandatory or whatever. It does put, obviously, a lot of an onus on us to think about how we might be causing near misses. Now, there are other circumstances where it's down to a thoughtlessness on an individual, so somebody might step out. Thoughtlessness on the part of a squirrel, obviously, is there as well. We can't do too much about that. But even where we are talking about thoughtlessness on the person driving a very heavy piece of machinery that could really hurt somebody, it's important that we as designers don't just say, well, they're kind of bad guys, thoughtless guys. It is possible to design environments where the negative consequences of somebody driving thoughtlessly won't have such a bad impact on cycling, and that could be a physical thing or, in this case, just a feeling of unsafety.
I mean, it does seem like conflict on the road, using the same space as a cyclist and as a car driver or an HGV driver, then this is causing a lot of the problem. Would you agree with that, Rachel, that it's mixing the modes and the speeds and the amounts of momentum that leads to this?
We ask people how scary or how annoying different incidents are, and you can break those down by the different other road users that are involved. So incidents involving a motor vehicle are more likely to be judged as very scary than incidents not involving a motor vehicle, and that stacks up with what we know, that people are nervous about sharing the roads with motor vehicles, particularly large amounts of motor vehicles, particularly heavy motor vehicles. And that backs up some other research I've done, which has looked at attitudes to safety clothing, which shows that people they take their helmets off if they're cycling along the canal, for example, that it's the fear of mixing with motor traffic that tends to make people scared. So, for example, a quarter of HGV-related incidents were judged as very scary. Similarly, a quarter of bus incidents for car incidents, it was a little bit lower. So you can see those very scary incidents are associated with mixing with motor vehicles, particularly heavy motor vehicles. I think, picking up on something that John said as well, I think these things go together. I agree with John that it's not just often isolated individuals not caring. There's also a broader system in that we have designed out cycling for a long time, and these kinds of attitudes go together. Attitudes from, say, politicians and policymakers traditionally, attitudes from engineers, attitudes from planners, attitudes from drivers. And one example is in terms of cost-benefit analysis on transport schemes, where one of the things that really gets prioritised is drivers shaving a few seconds off their journey, and that gets added up, and we get a really large economic benefit from that. And I was thinking about it, and I was thinking, actually, that is a bit like a must-get-in-front-close-pass. That's prioritising very small time savings, which often disappear. So I think you can see a structural attitude of disregard towards cyclists that we're all still struggling with, I think, wherever we are, whether we're cyclists, drivers, planners, and so on. And we're trying to get over that, and we're trying to do better. But I think we still have quite a way to go.
I think that we're all in a hurry is actually quite important, because we were joking the other day. I was driving, can't remember where, with family. And I was sitting there, I can't remember, somebody was turning, it wasn't a cyclist, it was a, I was sitting there in comedic form, really very funny, obviously, saying, I am scandalised because I'm now having to wait 5 seconds, and it feels quite a lot when you're slowed down at all, when you're behind the wheel of a thing that can go much faster. And when you're walking, it's not such a big deal, or cycling, it's not such a big deal, because you can slow down sometimes more easily, and you can speed. It doesn't seem like a big deal, and I think when that desire to be somewhere fast and sure, and the impatience is expressed by somebody behind the wheel of, as I say, a ton of metal, and it involves somebody who is much more vulnerable, then what was otherwise an annoying incident might end in a bit of a dent or just a little bit of a shouting match can change. It changes completely. And it's very interesting, those findings about how cyclists subjectively, basically the bigger and faster the thing is, so to speak, certainly the bigger it is, the more there's a fear of that, because there's just that feeling, I could be damaged more. So that's where it comes in. There is a general feeling, I think, that people are in a hurry. And when you're behind a wheel, that's kind of all right if you've got side impact bars and so are the other people. But when they don't, then it changes the game completely.
I mean, this seems to bring us to the subject of subjective safety, which is something that gets talked about a lot on the blogs, certain blogs out there. David Hembro and David Arditti talk a lot about it's much more important how people feel than what the statistics tell us about a road. And you, John, alluded to that earlier. Where does subjective safety come from as an idea in looking at, well, I guess transport, but other things as well?
Well, it has a history in traffic psychology from the 1970s, and it's actually linked to arguments around risk compensation, that if people feel safer, they may actually take on greater risks. So someone called Klebelsberg wrote about it in the 70s and talked specifically about drivers. As you got more safety gear in cars, drivers felt safer and they would take more risks with themselves, but also obviously with other people. So it kind of comes from that perspective, and it's interesting that recently it's been used more to talk about we need to create these subjectively safe environments to encourage walking and cycling, because I think perhaps in the 1970s, getting higher uptake of sustainable modes wasn't so much on that agenda, but now it is. And subjective safety is being looked at from the point of view of we need to create these environments where people who are walking and cycling don't feel threatened. And I think it's interesting that one thing that comes out of the research is that when people do feel safer, for example, as pedestrians, you see they're potentially more likely to step into the road. And that, in a sense, can be annoying for cyclists, people report, but in a sense, it's also a sign of a safe and pleasant environment. So yeah, I think it's coming out of the research in various ways.
John, do you think it's possible to take into account subjective safety, or do you prefer to deal with, the hard and fast of statistics?
Yeah, I'm a rubbish engineer because I think it's essential, and therefore I'm comfortable when I'm not dealing with hard and fast statistics. And in a sense, that's a problem we've often faced, which is if it doesn't have a number, it doesn't count. I suppose it's custom and practice. People often ask me, you've been away, John, you've been abroad, you've been to places. Can you tell me, give me a Dutch cycling expert or whatever it might be? And I say, no, not really. I can give you some really good Dutch traffic engineers, however. And that's the key thing, is that for them, cycling has just always been part of the world that they've had to design for. In this country, it's not. So we've got a lot to unlearn. And therefore, our feeling, our grasp of the importance of statistics related to stuff like this. I mean, my take in terms of subjective safety comes from a slightly different perspective, but it's something that we were aware of. Perhaps one of the best manifestations of it was a project that the Department of Transport sponsored early in the first decade of the new century, called Mixed Priority Routes Project. And essentially, this was a pilot project looking at how can we improve the conventional road safety performance of a bunch of high streets that we'd done just about everything conventional we used to do. We put guardrail everywhere, we'd signal stuff, we'd try to stop people doing the things that would put them into danger. And these particular streets were still remarkably resistant to that in terms of what the collision record was. And I think that's where we are increasingly coming at, as a profession, coming at this idea of subjective as opposed to objective safety from, which is we've done all that objective stuff and it didn't seem to have much of an impact, or rather it bottomed out. I think this, the same could be said, and I'm not having a particular dig here, for people who still persist on the idea that we should be encouraging cyclists to be vehicular cyclists, this idea of just take the road, have the confidence, do all of that. And you kind of think, well, yeah, OK, suppose that sounds like a reasonable theory, but it hasn't worked. It hasn't got lots and lots of people cycling. And it comes back a bit to that idea of subjectivity, of, for example, my sense of near misses. When I commute to work, which I do when the weather's nice, I've got lovely options, so I don't always take it. I don't mind at all, to be perfectly honest, cycling with busy traffic. A colleague of mine cycles 25 miles in and 25 miles out a day, up the A23. He doesn't mind so much, because he's just used to it. But that's a tiny proportion of the population. What if we are, this is the idea of effects, if we don't care about it, then that's all right. But actually, if feelings of subjective safety are stopping us reaching our policy targets, which include having a lot more people walking and cycling for very good reasons, all sorts of very good reasons, then we've got to take that into account. We may struggle to grasp what it is, but we cannot ignore it. Otherwise, we'll continue to design ineffective streets that don't meet our policy priorities.
Following on from that, I guess there's a few examples. One is partly just getting across the experience of what it feels like when you're on a bike to have these kinds of experiences, because I think John was talking about when you're behind the wheel of a car, it feels very different. And I think sometimes motorists just don't understand what it actually feels like when they give that cyclist only a few inches of space overtaking them. So trying to get that across to, say, driver training agencies, for example, is something that will be quite important.
So, Rachel, Kat, briefly, what's yet to come in the project? Because you're still mid-research, aren't you?
Yes. So one thing we're going to do is looking more at the specific types of locations and drawing out potentially lessons for local authorities, being in touch with specific places and saying, look, we've identified these places as hotspots potentially, which you might want to consider doing something about, but also categorising the different, for example, in terms of rural roads, and there's been relatively little work on cycling in rural areas, and we've got quite a few people whose commute or whose route or whatever does go through rural areas. So we can basically take all those coordinates. We've got the coordinates of where these incidents happened, almost all of them, and we can map them to road to the road network and look at the characteristics and then come up with some really quite detailed and rigorous recommendations based on that.
And Kat, on the how does it feel side of things, this is a side of things that I'm actually really interested in, because I don't think people who don't experience near misses have any idea how
bad and how horrible it feels and how off-putting it is to getting on a bike again, and how shaken up you feel as a result of a near miss. And what I'm very keen to do, and we asked when I spoke to you, Rachel, last year on the show, is to ask people to contribute in their own words their own near miss stories, and we'd like to compile those into something that I think will be quite compelling as a listen, and also very informative for people who are involved in designing the roads, to actually hear how people describe their own near-miss incidents in their own voices. And it's very easy to do that. We've set up something on the Near-Miss Project website and on the Bike Show website where you can, using your computer, you just speak into your computer as if you're recording an answering machine message. There are very clear instructions on doing that. If you use Audio Boom, the audio blogging software on your smartphone, which is a free app that's available there, you can record directly into there, and a couple of people have done that. Add the tag near miss to any posts that you make on Audio Boom, or just drop us an email, bikeshow@resonancefm.com, if you've done that. Or if you have some other way of recording, sending it by email, that'll work too. I'm quite excited about hearing people's own stories, because there's a certain amount you can get from an online survey, but actually hearing people in their own voices is something different, isn't it? It takes us into sort of oral history and ethnography, or I don't know. What does it take us into, Kat?
Well, it gives us that real feeling of how people are feeling. And I think a lot of that comes through the kind of written stories. But as you were saying, to actually hear it in people's own voices will be really powerful and exciting. Because in the research, you know, even reading them, we're certainly getting a spectrum of experiences, from being kind of just a bit peeved, a bit irked, to annoyed, to frustrated, to quite scared. But also there's resignation that comes through this. There's this ordinariness, which we were also very interested in the ways in which people keep cycling, because these things don't always stop cyclists. You know, a lot of us have these near-miss experiences. And as negative as sometimes this can sound, you know, these are also not things that get us off our bicycles. You know, we keep cycling. The conditions of London and in other kind of places around the UK are such that we experience incredible joy in cycling, but wrapped up in all of that is some of these experiences where we would rather not have. And I think that's, in exploring some of these, we're hoping to gather them together and find ways in which we might be able to at least limit them for some people.
So, John, you're not part of the project. Have Kat and Rachel whetted your appetite to hear more about near misses, and what would you like to come out of this project to inform your practice as someone who actually does get down there and do the work of designing our streets?
I think the key thing, we spoke earlier about numbers and so forth, and the key thing is to get some data out there that is accessible enough for us to think, well, this is how it can inform the designs that we do. Obviously, this is a study at a fairly global level, you know, but this gives us keys as well as to how we might think about looking at any specific scheme and who we might speak to about how the design for that works.
Okay, well, thank you, Dr. Rachel Aldred, Dr. Kat Young-Nicol, and John Dales. Thanks all. And we should also mention at this point that the Near Miss Project is supported by Creative Exchange and Blaze, who make the interesting new bike lights that put a cyclist in green lights on the road ahead of you. So thanks all. You're tuned to Resonance 104.4 FM. This has been The Bike Show with me, Jack Thurston. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.